PG&E's pending Chapter 11 bankruptcy raises a range of questions. How will it affect rates, power, and fire victims among them? Today on Inside, Capital Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief Ben Adler is here to explain what impact the legislature might have on it all. Also in our Capital Chat with Ben, Governor Newsom has had a whopping 2 weeks on the job. We'll talk about what Ben's learned in all that time. Also today, Gary Vercelli just returned from the Jazz Congress in New York City, which is a summit of top jazz professionals. Gary brought back some great new music for this week's Sound Advice. And we'll hear about the new play Make Believe and its soundtrack from Dalrymple McAlpin, a talented guy who's a playwright, poet, composer, and a puppeteer who perfected that talent in, wait for it, the Czech Republic. I'm Rick Cushman, in for Beth Rujek. That's today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Rick Cushman, in for Beth Rujek. PG&E this week said it intends to file Chapter 11 bankruptcy at the end of the month. It's facing mounting criticism and mounting debt after 2 years of horrific wildfires, including, of course, the campfire that leveled Paradise and surrounding region this fall. On this week's Capital Chat, we have lots of ground to cover, including 2 whole weeks worth of impressions of California's new governor, but we're starting with a look at that bankruptcy and how state lawmakers are reacting to the questions it brings up. Capital Public Radio, Capital Bureau Chief Ben Adler is in the studio this morning to tell us what he's hearing. So, Ben, nice to see you again.
You too, Rick. And you know what? As long as it's been since you and I have spoken on this show, it feels like it's been almost that long since Jerry Brown made his way to that ranch.
Exactly right. It feels like forever. So we're going to talk a little bit about how things have changed in the building and in the Capitol overall, but let's talk about the PG&E bankruptcy. So how much can lawmakers affect the process or impact anything?
Well, my understanding is there, I mean, look, lawmakers have a choice. They can try to come up with some package of, critics would call it a bailout, but it would be, you know, some package of money or incentives or whatever to keep PG&E out of bankruptcy. Obviously, they would demand things in return from PG&E. Whether that could pass political muster remains to be seen, as well as financial muster, and whether PG&E would do it, would agree to do it or not, also remains to be seen. That is probably a decision that only one person can make, whether he even wants to pursue it, and that is Gavin Newsom. Mm. I don't see any movement in the legislature independently. And Newsom said earlier this week, as we heard on Insight on Tuesday from the folks that Beth had on, that he's looking at all of these different options. And if you ask him, is he considering it? Yeah, he'll say he's considering it, but no decisions have been made. And my sense is that continues to be true right now.
Yeah, are lawmakers proposing ideas? I mean, often in a situation like this, people on the right committees or just in the regions or certainly who represent some of the wildfire areas or PG&E areas are proposing things. Is there any consensus building of any kind?
No, I don't think there's any consensus because I think there's anything that happens here is going to have to be led by the leader of the state, Gavin Newsom. It is that big of a deal. It is that big of a political risk for a governor, let alone, lawmakers who will be up for reelection 2 years sooner than this governor will be to, take a vote like this. So, look, when you go into bankruptcy, California would lose a lot of control that it has over PG&E, right? And state laws wouldn't apply. Federal bankruptcy laws would hold true. Ratepayers would pay more. That seems pretty clear. Wildfire victims would likely get something, but they might not necessarily get everything that they would be adjudged to deserve through the normal state court system. If those lawsuits go forward. And California's climate goals could suffer significantly because PG&E has been, at California's insistence, doing a lot of investment in renewable portfolio standard. That's RPS. That's a wonky acronym. But basically to help California produce renewable energy. So a lot of reasons California might suffer. And of course, PG&E doesn't really want to go into bankruptcy. But of course, here we are.
Right. And I mean, part of this is simply the complexity of the issue. And I know you've talked to people about this, and I think we have a soundbite from one of your conversations.
Yeah, that's going to be a Democratic Senator Bob Hertzberg, who was Assembly Speaker during the 2001 bankruptcy. And he was talking about the challenge of how California might respond to this potential bankruptcy filing.
This is a really hard issue. It's a hard decision. It's not just hard politically, but it's hard in the sense that these are very significant challenges that we're currently facing, and we've got to be really thoughtful about kind of recreating what these things look like. You know, these things happen various throughout history, and this is one of those points in time where it's going to require us to do some pretty deep homework.
Yeah, and I mean, there's that pretty much says it all, right? This is just going to be difficult on any level. I think there's another piece of this too, and I know you've talked to him about that. You know, but bankruptcy courts tend to focus on money and the debt. I mean, that's their job. Can the legislature impact that? Can they impact what the court might decide, or you know, the impact of what the court has decided?
State law can't trump federal law. So when you're in federal bankruptcy court, the state can say, PG&E needs to do X, but that's not really going to hold true in bankruptcy court. Now, the conditions upon the exit from bankruptcy and what PG&E would be required to comply with after the fact, that's obviously going to be a state issue. The California Public Utilities Commission may have some say, or at least be able to be heard before the bankruptcy judge. But Senator Hertzberg, when I asked him about the lessons from PG&E's 2001 bankruptcy, in which, unlike this situation, there's plenty of electricity now, we are told, no risk of any brownouts. But, in 2001, there was no electricity and PG&E was in stronger financial shape and yet still emerged intact with ratepayers and taxpayers footing the bill. So here's Hertzberg about the lessons from that 2001 bankruptcy.
The lessons to me are just how powerful the bankruptcy courts are in these situations, how all the laws that we spend so many years writing simply are ignored. Contracts are ignored. And so the power of bankruptcy courts and the literally laser-like focus that they have on protecting the creditors in these situations. They don't have an obligation for any public policy areas of clean energy or protecting the victims like we do. You know, safety might be an issue viewed through the idea of, well, that could cause more liability for the utility. But they're just like a business person. They don't care about the other issues. That, to me, was one of the most important lessons out of 2001.
So what that sounds like is it really is up to the state, if anyone, to have some impact on what the bankruptcy, how the bankruptcy might affect everything from rates and taxpayers to energy supply and wildfire victims. You know, and that tie between wildfire victims and rates has always been something that's been debated. You know, we want wildfire victims to be made whole. We don't want the utility to start, in essence, abandon them. But at the same time, where everyone is nervous about rate changes. So is there any thought in the building about how the legislature might deal with that issue?
I think that's, again, the question. But we are, I'm going to circle back to, we're going to have to wait and see what Gavin Newsom wants to do, right? Because individual lawmakers may have ideas, may have preferences. Last year in the big debate over wildfire liability, you had some lawmakers who were willing and thought it was necessary to give PG&E exactly what it wanted, which is changing the liability law known as inverse condemnation, which basically currently says that, PG&E is going to be liable for damages for wildfires caused by its electrical equipment, even if the utility acted responsibly. Right. So there were lawmakers who wanted to change that. And yet that didn't get through. And I don't think, Governor Brown was open to making that change, too. But again, the political will wasn't there for that. And I can't imagine the political will being here for a bailout or even, critics are going to call anything a bailout. So a bailout can be a meaningful or meaningless label. Right. But in this case, look, you'd be looking at a package of financial aid for PG&E and potentially wildfire victims in exchange for PG&E agreeing to do certain things differently. I would have to imagine it would not be a status quo coming out of this in exchange for money. Or I think you would have a lot more people calling it a bailout than if there were some real hard conditions involved. But I don't think talks have gotten started about that yet. I don't know if Gavin Newsom's decided what he wants to do yet.
Well, and, speaking of changes, one of the things that might change is the nature of PG&E. And that's certainly something somebody's tossed out the notion of breaking them up or reorganizing, and that may come out of the bankruptcy as well. I know you've talked to somebody about that one as well, right?
And that is Republican Assemblyman James Gallagher, who represents Paradise. This guy, by the way, evacuated his family when the Oroville Dam was at risk of get that crisis there. And now also represents the Paradise area. So he is no stranger to disasters hitting his district. And here's what he said about and pretty aggressively for a Republican, saying, look, whatever happens, I don't want PG&E to emerge the way it is right now.
Back under the energy crisis, basically when that bankruptcy happened, PG&E came out pretty much the same company, but all of our ratepayers were left holding the bag. We're the ones that had to pay. I don't want to see that happen again, you know? So if they're going into bankruptcy, what should come out, it should be something very different than what we've seen before, you know? And I think there should be strong considerations to, you know, either a substantial reorganization of PG&E or a breakup. You know, because we don't want the same old thing. You know, we're done with that from a ratepayer standpoint, from a safety standpoint. So if they're going to go try and get the protections of federal bankruptcy law, we want to see them come out a very different organization than what they are right now.
We've been talking about the PG&E bankruptcy with our Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler on this week's Capitol Chat. But there is a lot of other things to talk about.
And
as you said, you know, it's not like a crazy big news week, but there's just many, many things. I know you have some news about a state bail referendum.
It is qualified for the November 2020 ballot. So we're talking about this this effort from the bail industry to give voters the opportunity to reject, to overturn this law passed last year amid great fanfare that would eliminate cash bail in California, making it the first state, along with Washington, D.C., to eliminate cash bail entirely. And instead, it would replace the cash bail system with a pretrial release system, which would base those decisions on whether to let inmates go before trials on inmates' risks to the public and their flight risks. Now, this measure got through last year over the objections of the industry. And to be fair, there were many groups on the left who felt that there was going to be some bias toward minority inmates in this new system, and they felt it wasn't fair as written. But I don't know or think for sure that they are going to. You know, I think it remains to be seen whether they're going to align themselves with the bail industry on this referendum to go back to the old system. But here's why this matters. Not only does this referendum qualifying give the industry the chance to ask voters to reject the law, it also freezes the law's implementation until voters weigh in. So here we are in January of 2019. This law was set to take effect in October of this year, but everyone had started getting ready and started courts and counties had tried to come up with, you know, the systems they were going to use. But now it will not be implemented unless and until this measure, this referendum, is defeated. In other words, a yes vote on this referendum in November 2020, Proposition X, whatever the ballot measure number will be, a yes vote on this proposition will overturn the new bail law and revert California to the previous slash current system.
Put us back where we currently are without any changes. Who's
correct
behind this referendum, by the way?
The bail industry.
The bail industry.
Bail industry.
Okay.
And a no vote will leave the new law, this pretrial release system based on flight risk and public safety risk, in place.
All right. And we are in the middle of this week's Capitol Chat with our Capitol Bureau Chief, Ben Adler. So on the legislative front, Ben, there continues to be changes. It seems like almost weekly. Maybe I'm being just a little bit short on that.
A little bit.
State Republicans elected a new minority leader this week. So what can you tell us about her?
Well, she is...
This is Shannon Grove.
It's Shannon Grove of Bakersfield. She replaces Pat Bates of Orange County effective March 1st. And it's the third Senate Republican caucus leader in the last 3.5 years. Assembly Republicans have also gone through a lot of leadership changes recently. Marie Waldron of Escondido, she's the current leader. She's the fifth leader of that caucus in just over 4 years, dating back to November of 2014. And some of that was during the era of term limits. Some of the earlier leaders in those spans were in the term limit age. But right now you have this new set of term limits where you can serve up to 12 years in each house. Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon took over a couple of years after his 12 years began, and he still has nearly 6 years left in his eligibility in the assembly if he wants to be speaker, or if he's able to, you know, keep the support of his colleagues to be speaker for that long. Senate President Pro Tem Tony Atkins has another 6 years, I believe, of eligibility left in the state Senate. So Republicans are churning through their leaders more quickly. And at a time when Republicans have a very low registration in California, and they now control barely a quarter of the seats in the state legislature, only 7 of 53 congressional districts, they picked Republicans in the state Senate picked Shannon Grove, who is a close ally of minority leader in the House, Kevin McCarthy, who in turn is a close ally of President Trump. President Trump, not the most popular person in California. So a couple observations on that leadership.
Well, and that's the question. Is there a, I mean, there's sort of two questions to this. Operationally, when they keep changing heads, it tends to weaken a caucus simply because they just don't have consistency. But and so the question is, how much does that change how the caucus operates? But also, is there a split among the GOP senators? Because I know a few of them have been arguing for, you know, let's sort of back off of this, you know, in intensity and try, since we are at a minority in registration and the state seems to be more or less or less socially conservative, we should take that approach. So is there some split within the Senate caucus, or is this a signal that they're not split at all?
Well, I've had a couple of people suggest that the reason Pat Bates, the current Republican leader, is stepping down is she just kind of lost the fire in her belly for it. It's a hard job in the best of times, and these are not the best of times for California Republicans. So that could have something to do with it. The leaders in the assembly have fairly consistently adhered to the view of, look, we need to, as California Republicans, you know, change something, change what we're doing at least somewhat in order to become a viable party again. There are debates within the caucus over that. Chad Mays, a former Assembly Republican leader who remains in the Assembly, lost his leadership after leading a block of Republicans to vote with Jerry Brown on the cap and trade extension a couple years ago. But some of that frustration wasn't about voting for it. It was about the fact that he, as leader, didn't really keep everyone in the loop on it, didn't do a lot of good communication, and kind of led a minority of his caucus in a direction that the caucus didn't want to go. Had he not been leader, had he just been a rank and file member and done a lot of that negotiating, I don't know if he would have come in for quite as much scorn from his colleagues. Right. And then my understanding is there's also just a difference of opinion on certain matters between Kevin McCarthy and the state Republican Party helmed currently, though only for another month or so, by Jim Brulte. So there's some other dynamics at play there that are so inside baseball that it probably doesn't even behoove discussion in this relatively inside baseball segment.
Exactly,
of the
right
show.
Well, you know, one more semi-inside baseball question on this, which is, what kind of impact can this party have at this point inside the legislature with the relatively low numbers that the Republicans have in both houses? Will they even have impact on the budget process or on bills, or is it personal charm that's going to get anything through from any Republican?
Probably the latter. You've got a situation where right now, with 60 out of 80 Democrats in the Assembly, 29 out of 40 Republicans in the Senate, although there are now two vacancies because two senators, one in each party, were elected statewide constitutional officers. So that means it's 28 to 10, but it'll probably, those are safe seats in both cases, probably go up back up to 29-11.
Yeah, I mean, basically it's taking three quarters in each and plus in each House. I mean, it doesn't give the Republicans a whole lot of room to maneuver, does it?
And you need, Democrats need two-thirds for certain things like ballot measures, like tax and fee increases. Not that Democrats are chomping at the bit, not that all Democrats are chomping at the bit to raise taxes and fees. Some maybe, but not all. And those are hard votes to take. We've heard suggestions of a 911 fee from Governor Newsom. He said a clean water fee might need to get voted on. There's the individual mandate that there's some debate whether it would take a majority or two-thirds vote. And, you know, any expansion of paid family leave would require a new revenue source. And Newsom has floated, although saying he's not saying this is the idea, but he has certainly floated the possibility of, you know, a payroll tax increase or change in how that system works. Those are all very hard votes that are going to be hard for Democrats, even with a three-quarters, gigamajority, are going to be hard for Democrats to get to two-thirds. And Democrats or Republicans have no reason to help them.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, look, what you do in this situation is you build your relationships. And if you have a priority that you feel strongly about, you work with Democrats and you hope you can find a way to get it through.
Right. Well, and we saved, speaking of Governor Newsom, we saved him for last. But there's a lot to talk about, including rent control, which we'll want to get to. But I'm curious, does the building feel different now that Governor Brown is not the parent in the room as he sort of felt like at times? Is there a different mood, different atmosphere there?
I think everyone is still trying to acclimate and kind of see where everything is going to set itself up. So a couple of points. I should point out that under Jerry Brown, the state budget general fund went from 80-something billion dollars in 2011 to 133 or so billion dollars in the current fiscal year's budget. That's an increase of more than 50%. So to some extent, the budget did go up significantly under Jerry Brown, and we will see what happens under Gavin Newsom. I mean, if the economy tanks, that's not going to be the case. Newsom is proposing budget priorities much more in line with legislative Democrats than Jerry Brown.
Right.
But Jerry Brown, whenever he proposes budgets and for all of the fiscal austerity rhetoric, he would always leave a pad for negotiating. He would always have some amount of money in his mind, in the Department of Finance's mind, or on paper set aside, okay, as we get toward the budget deal, there's going to be some space for legislative priorities. And lawmakers would then go through their budget process and they would come up with, assembly priorities, Senate priorities, and each chamber would get some of what they wanted and they'd all figure out which numbers to get. And there would always be something there that the lawmakers could claim victory for. And Jerry Brown knew that that was important politically for the other, in theory, co-equal branch
right.
of state government.
Sure. And for his relationships and for getting everything else he needed.
Yeah. Right. So as frustrated as lawmakers could be with Jerry Brown sometimes not seeing eye to eye with him on certain things, for example, early childhood education, not a priority for Jerry Brown the way it is for Gavin Newsom and for many lawmakers, including Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon, who's made that a big issue for himself. And Jerry didn't focus as much on housing and homelessness, which is a huge priority for Senate President Pro Tem Tony Atkins. So as much as that's the case, they still had their areas that they could claim victory on. Now, if Newsom's taking all of these ideas that have been bubbling up in the legislature, and I'm sure some are Gavin Newsom's ideas too, and putting them all forth in January, well, there's some question where that leaves for all of the negotiations between now and June. And, that's one thing I'm still trying to find
interesting
out.
Interesting to see where that would go. You know, one of the subjects that has been a little interesting, I mean, there's this feeling that, as you just mentioned, in fact, all those subjects you mentioned were things that Gavin Newsom sort of campaigned on. These were, you know, those issues, including early childhood education and housing, big deals. One of the others was rent control or rent stabilization, as the gentler word is. there's been some talk that he's backing off on that. Where does that all stand?
Well, I don't know that. So Gavin Newsom, when he campaigned, came out publicly opposed to Proposition 10. He said it
right.
went too far. So I don't know that you can say he campaigned on rent control. He did campaign and say, look, we know this is a problem. This is a crisis. We need to do something to address this. And he called for his somewhat mocked 3.5 million new houses goal, new homes or goal for what, 6 years, over a 6 year span. And he's put forth some proposals in his budget and he's floated some ideas on how to get started on that. But as far as, you know, and supply and demand is going to be a big key toward lowering or making rents more affordable, making mortgages and home prices more affordable. But as far as for the addressing the issue right now, that is the question of rate stabilization. On Tuesday in San Jose, he was at a roundtable with San Jose Mayor Sam Liccardo, and he said that are working with some of the biggest developers in the state and the biggest advocates and the Apartment Association and the Realtors and others to pursue what we perceive as a compromise around Proposition 10. And he said, look, our conversations are underway about rent caps. He said the word rent caps. And then his administration had to clean it up and apologize a little bit and say what he meant to say really was that lawmakers are having conversations. We're involved in monitoring, too. We are not interested in a cap on prices. We are looking to find a way to limit the percentage increase that a rent can go up at any given time. So and all of that is still under negotiation, exactly how that would work. So walking it back a little bit. Meantime, the California Apartment Association, I checked with them, says it continues to be open to discussions with the governor and legislature to, address the housing crisis and avoid displacing tenants. So the governor, I think, got ahead of things a bit. But it's certainly an issue that is on a lot of people's minds, including the governor, including the Apartment Association, which I think probably understands that something is going to come out of the legislature and it won't be Prop 10, but needs to come out of the legislature, and they need to shape it and prepare their members for it.
All right. Well, that's just the start of all issues we're going to be talking to you about our new governor as things develop. And we have lots more information on all these topics and on all of our reporting from the Capitol on our website at capradio.org/insight. Ben, great to talk to you. Good to see you again. And we're going to keep you looking at all this entire pile of issues and have you back soon.
Thanks, Rick. Good to see you.
You are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capitol Public Radio. We'll be back. You're listening to Insight on Capitol Public Radio. I'm Rick Cushman, in for Beth Brujak. Every year, Jazz Times and Jazz at Lincoln Center join forces in New York City to create what is, in effect, a high-level summit of jazz musicians, broadcasters, and recording professionals. Cap Radio's jazz music director, Gary Vercelli, was at this year's Jazz Congress earlier this month, and of course he would be there. And he brought back a few gems. He shared them with Randall White in this week's Sound Advice.
Yes, I was at the Jazz Congress. It was a fabulous event. It involved people from all phases of the industry, broadcasters, musicians, critics, etc. One of the best panels that impressed me the most was a panel of Art Blakey Seidman. Art was a famous jazz drummer. And Wynton Marsalis, Branford Marsalis, Bobby Watson, many, many musicians passed through his band. So they had 30 alumni that had attended the Art Blakey University, as it were. And they spoke very highly of him, not only as a great musician, but they concentrated on what they learned from him in the manner of how to lead a band, which I thought was interesting because you've got all different personalities in bands.
Right.
And then, of course, when I'm in New York, I love to go out and hear some live jazz because it still remains the capital of the jazz world. And I heard Francesca Tanksley, along with Billy Harper's group. She's been a member of his band for many, many years. And Billy's a real titan of the tenor saxophone. During the break, I asked her if she had any product out. And she had a release back in 2002 that I wasn't aware of. So she gave me a copy of it. And let's check it out.
So Gary, Francesca's a pianist, and she started at the Berklee College of Music at age 16?
Yeah, she came to the States for the first time. She was born in Italy and raised in Germany, and she came to Berklee. Then she went back to Germany, and then she joined Billy's band in 1983, and they've toured the world together. But this is interesting, hearing her in a trio setting with other Billy Harper sidemen. She really lays down some percussive block chords with her left hand and makes some nice runs with her right hand. Reminds me a lot of McCoy Tyner's style, and nothing wrong with that. So I'd have to say Francesca is deserving of wider recognition, and I hope she puts another album out soon.
Yeah. So, Gary, your next cut is by the band Something Blue.
Yeah, Something Blue is a band put together by producer Mark Free. He's got a small but potent label called Positone Records, and it kind of reminds me of Blue Note Records in the 60s, although it's very forward-looking as well. Some of the members of this band include Alexa Tarantino, you'll hear her on alto saxophone, and pianist Art Hirahara. Yeah, Alexa plays very well on alto saxophone, and she's a talent to be looked at in the future. And good straight-ahead jazz from that band. The tune was called Slick, and it was written by Ben Galise. He's a vibist. He wasn't on this date, but he's a prolific composer, and he's got a Positone album coming out soon as well.
And for your next cut, Gary, we hear from a Bay Area DJ and pianist.
Yeah, Dick Connie. He's been on the scene a long time. A lot of people tease me like, wow, how long have you been at Capital Public Radio? And I'm like, not as long as Dick Connie's been in the business. So we old Italians, we just keep ticking, I guess. But Dick's a great pianist. He lives up in the wine country now in Sonoma. But he recorded this at the Berkeley Studios, at Fantasy Studios in Berkeley, I should say, just before the studio was shuttered, September 15th. So the album's called Blue and Green, and here's a reading of Come Rain or Come Shine. Some beautiful voicings and rhythmic sensibilities, just like Bill Evans,
and
Dick Honey.
Gary, if I understand correctly, the piano that Dick is using there is significant.
Yeah, it was used by Bill Evans at the Fantasy Studios, and he played on the piano, the same piano, Steinway, that Bill Evans, famous jazz pianist, had used. Dick had actually recorded an interview with Bill Evans shortly before he passed away when Dick was on K-Jazz, and Dick remains on the air on KCSM in San Mateo. It's very indicative of what's going on in the Bay Area that famous studio has closed down, real estate values being what they are. Unfortunate, but it also kind of reflects the recording industry now. A lot of people are making albums in their garage, in their dens.
Yeah, I guess technology has also gotten to the point where it's easier to do that
sort of
thing.
Makes it much easier.
Mm-hmm. Chuck Dierdorf is your next cut?
Yeah, he's a first call bassist in Seattle. He's got impressive educational credentials. He's taught at the Cornish College of the Arts. And this is a tune I think you'll recognize. It's a pop tune written by Stevie Winwood, Can't Find My Way Home. And Chuck takes the lead here on bass. He carries the melody.
That's really nice.
The pianist is Don Clement. The bass player engages nicely with the pianist. I like it.
Mm-hmm. And you're going to round things out with Pat Bianchi.
This is the brand new album from organist Pat Bianchi. He's been a member of Pat Martino's band for many years. And Pat returns the favor here by being a guest artist on one track called Mr. PM. Pat Martino's a vibrant guitarist. He's had some health issues, but he's back playing and touring. I think the interaction between the two is quite outstanding. Yeah, Pat Martino just flying on guitar there. Beautiful, great lines. Nobody can cook like these guys. It's a great album. Good straight-ahead jazz.
That was Gary Vercelli and Randall White talking about some of the outstanding jazz you can hear on our music stations for this week's Sound Advice. We have links and lots more on our website at capradio.org/insight. And you are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. We'll be right back. You are listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Rick Cushman, in for Beth Rubiak. Dalrymple McAlpin is an interesting guy. He's a playwright, composer, poet, and puppeteer. He studied puppeteering in the Czech Republic, and we are definitely going to ask him about that. His second theatrical production is called Make Believe, an archetypal musical theater fairy tale for the young and young at heart. It's a musical based on 19th century fairy tales, and it has a look of something poetic and magical, and he's going to have to tell us a little bit more about that one, too. It'll run at Nevada City Theater in Nevada City from January 25th to February 3rd. Dalrymple is with us this morning to tell us about the musical and the soundtrack that's coming out the same time as his production. Dalrymple, welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having me, Rick. Play.
Well, before we get to the play, because okay. I have a very important question before the play.
Sure.
I want to know about you studying puppetry in the Czech Republic. The prestigious International Institute Puppets in Prague. You got to tell us what that was.
Puppets in Prague. So the next thing I'm doing after Make Believe is a marionette opera based on a original backstory I'm writing of how Rumpelstiltskin got his power to spin straw into gold. And so this will be a fully realized marionette theater with stringed puppets with moving mouths. So I had to go there to learn how to do that.
I mean, where are you from, by the way? Where are you from initially?
Michigan. Right on Lake Erie.
All right. So how does a young man from Michigan find his way to Prague to study puppeteering? How'd you know about this? Is this the place?
I had been in touch with a puppet. Prague is the place for puppetry in Europe. Prague, Czech Republic and Germany. Both. I did a whole touring circuit there through different puppet theaters in Germany, in Dusseldorf, Augsburg, and Salzburg in Austria, and various puppet theaters around in Prague, just to learn this technique and learn from the masters over there.
Wow. That's pretty cool. That's kind of exotic. All right, so let's talk about Make Believe. You said it's loosely based on the real life of the six Wild sisters who lived next door to the Brothers Grimm. Okay, that's kind of a nice setup. Tell us about what that connection is and what the play is about.
So I had written the play based on these six sisters before I knew about the six sisters who lived next door to the Brothers Grimm. And each sister in the play, one speaks only in riddles. One is a dancer. One is very superstitious. One is a bookworm. You know, they have these unique personalities. And then after writing the play, I learned about these six sisters that live next door to the Brothers Grimm. So it was sort of the synchronistic aha moment of, oh, I'm on the right path, you know, and tapping into this archetypal fairy tale mythos. So that felt like, a great urge forward, you know, from the Brothers Grimm. And one of the brothers, Wilhelm Grimm, actually married one of the Wild sisters, Dorchen Wild.
Wow. So was it the sisters in essence just sort of inspiration for the brothers, or was it the stuff they did that the brothers started writing about, which sounds like you wrote about as well?
Yeah, the brothers collected many of the fairy tales people know today from these sisters, Rumpelstiltskin, Cinderella, Puss in Boots, a lot of the Fair Sleeping Beauty, a lot of the most famous Grimm's fairy tales were collected from these sisters. They collected them from, you know, kind of upper class, you know, women, as opposed to popular belief that they were collecting them from peasants, you know, way out in the country. They were actually collecting them from their next door neighbors.
Oh, that's kind of cool. All right, so your musical production is it just a series of fairy tale like episodes, or what's
it's a whole story from beginning to end. It's not, you know, episodic. It's tells a tale of two twins, one representing all that is pure and good and sparkling with crystal dewdrops to everyone's delight, the Theodora Willowwand, and her twin brother Thistlethorn Witherwand, who is all that is poison and malevolent with spite. And so they're sort of these one-dimensional characters, bad and good. And so the sister gives birth to these six daughters, and Thistlethorn, her brother, in his jealousy, kidnaps the daughters away from the mother and brings them from the other world. These are fairy beings. He brings them from the other world into this drab mortal plane where we live, and he drops them on the steps of this dilapidated old orphanage run by Agnes Pumpernickel. And so the mother, meanwhile, in the other world, trades her tears for six conjuring candles, and she goes blind by trading her tears, her sacrifice, and she uses the candles to summon the mystical guardian of each daughter.
Right. Well, there you go. That's it does sound mystical and old school nursery rhyme sort of thing. It's is it aimed at adults, at kids, some combination of both?
I think it's all ages. Yeah, my son is 5 years old. he's been to every rehearsal. He has the whole play like memorized, and the play has the youngest person in the play is a 7-year-old, the youngest of the sisters, and the oldest is a woman in her 70s. So it's all ages are in the cast. And I think all ages could appreciate it.
Yeah. I know music is a big part of this, and we're going to talk about your album in just a minute. But let's hear just a little bit of the music from the musical.
Give me your hand and take this key. Here is a door.
That was the prelude from the musical Make Believe. I'm talking with Dalrymple McAlpin about his musical production that runs at the Nevada City Theater in Nevada City from January 25th to February 3rd. So there's an album that comes out along with it. This is no small thing. As I understand, the soundtrack is a double vinyl LP and CD. It was 3 years in the making and features musicians and two choirs, like 35 musicians. Do I have that correct?
And
two choirs. So such a minor little effort. Tell me about what it took to put that together.
That took, it just took a lot of time. Some of the pieces I wrote over 10 years ago and had been developing through the years and found an avenue of this record, this idea for Make Believe, that, you know, creating this narrative of beginning and end. So, yeah, the album reflects a lot of years of studying music composition, orchestration, music theory, and incorporating a lot of classical instruments into the mix, like bassoon and horns and bass clarinet and timpani and orchestral bells and various things. And the choir, we have a children's choir and an adult medieval choir.
So what came first, the music or the play?
The music.
The music came, and it inspired the thought of the play?
Yeah. First it was just this music, and I was going to do a show, you know, performing the music for the album, and I thought, I want to turn this into a play, and so I found the story within the music, so to speak, you know.
Oh, very interesting. So with all the things that you do, composer, poet, playwright, puppeteer, Are any of these your core? Is this how you earn your living? Is there do you have like a day job and do this on your late into the night?
Yeah, my goal is to be able to do this for a living. I definitely, you know, make some money doing plays and stuff. I've was in a band for over 10 years, about 12 years with my last ensemble, Lasher Keen. And we gradually started doing more and more theatrical things in our shows to the point where I thought, I'm just going to give a stab at writing plays, which has definitely been more lucrative than the previous incarnation of being just a band.
Well, and I don't know what that says, actually, because people always complain they can't make a living writing plays. So either you're good at it or the band wasn't doing all that well. So now you've got music on stage. You've got 15 actors. They also sing. We're going to hear just a little bit more from the music in your play. Gog Magog, the name of the song from the play Make Believe. Dalrymple, that is apparently a notable person singing that.
Yeah, that is John Ames, the basso profundo octavist you just heard. He's sung in countless operas, touring around the world. He's the role of Fasolt the Giant in Wagner's Ring Cycle. He's been in Mozart's Requiem, Stravinsky's Les Noces, and quite amazing to have this gentleman in our ensemble.
So collecting actors and singers, I mean, and something with the kind of tone that you have, is it difficult finding actors and singers for something like this?
No. I say if you write it, they will come. And that is true. You just create something. And this was my last play. And people just come. And so many people have devoted, you know, it's too long to list. But, you know, I'm just so thankful to everyone who believes in Make Believe and is helping make this world a reality.
And is there a future project now that you've got all this, got this loaded, and you just finished 3 years of putting together an album? What's next on the list?
So next is the Rumpelstiltskin Marionette Opera, which we talked about earlier today. So a fully realized puppet opera, which I've already been writing most of the music for, carving the puppets. So that is underway. But my fiance, Angela Holm, who's doing live projections for this show, has told me I need to just pursue Make Believe as far as I can take it. And I plan to take it to Sacramento, B Street Theater. I'd like to get in there, San Francisco, LA, and so on. Take it as far as I can.
I like that notion, pursue Make Believe. It's a good theme. Dalrymple McAplin's new musical is called Make Believe, an archetypal musical theater fairy tale for the young and young at heart. You can see it at the Nevada Theater in Nevada City from January 25th, which is next Friday, to February 3rd. We have ticket information, videos, links, and all kinds of information on our website at capradio.org/inside. Dalrymple, great to talk to you. Congratulations on finishing a pretty ambitious project.
Thank you, Rick.
Thanks for coming in. And that is Inside for today. I'm Rick Cushman, in for Beth Rujek. Inside is produced by Bert Johnson and Cody Drabble. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. Today's engineer was Anthony Van Hook. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our managing editor is Linnea Edmeyer. Our theme music was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. And Inside's executive producer is Joe Barr. We're back with another live show Tuesday after the holiday. And once again, as always, thanks for joining us.